Welcome. This is Joe Aguirre in studio once again with astrophysicist Jeff Swearink, biochemist Fuzz Rana, and philosopher-theologian Kenneth Samples addressing theistic evolution. Fuzz, on this one, we want to address the topic of common descent because for many people, this seems to be an unassailable argument. So you want to address that for us because this is a tough one for a lot of people.
Well, you know, the thing is, the evidence that is ultimately cited in favor of biological evolution is something called homology. And homology basically means organisms have shared structures. The structures that are shared may superficially look different, but fundamentally they're the same structure. So the classic example of homologies would be the forelimbs of vertebrates. So if you look at the human forelimb, you have the long bone, the humerus, there's the radius, the ulna, there are wrist bones, hand bones, and then the fingers, the phalanges. And that structure, that architecture is found in all mammals. So the horse's front legs, even though they have hooves, the hoof is actually a toe, a modified toe. But it's the same design, you know, a bat's wing, the whale's flipper, a dog's paw. These are all fundamentally the same designs. Again, it's called a pentadactyl architecture. And the idea here is because these organisms have these shared structures, that reflects common ancestry, common descent from an ancestor who had that structure, that design feature. And as the organisms diverged from that common ancestor, those features underwent modification to adapt the organism to the different environments that they lived in. But nevertheless, because they have the same shared structure, it means that they must have common ancestry. There's something fundamental about the design that is shared, though the structures may look superficially different and may even function in a different manner. That idea is fairly easy to respond to from a creationist perspective. Because while an evolutionist might look at this and say, well, this is evidence for common ancestry, you could look at this as a design proponent, as a creationist, and say, well, this is also evidence for a common template, a common blueprint. And could not a creator use a common design elements, but structure those elements in different ways as he brought about his creative purposes? In fact, the scientist who discovered the phenomena of homology, Sir Richard Owen, who predated Charles Darwin and was considered the United Kingdom's greatest scientist of his day, actually, when he discovered the phenomenon of homology, viewed it as being essentially an archetype that existed in the mind of a creator that was then materially manifested in different ways. It would be similar, Ken, to Plato's idea of the forms, right, where there's this universe that where you have this perfect reality, and then the physical universe is kind of an imperfect manifestation of that.
Mm, very interesting.
So, you know, it's a Platonic form of biology. Well, this idea of homology now is being translated to a molecular scale. With the advent of genomics, the Human Genome Project, where the entire genetic content of a human being is sequenced, and of course, this is true for other organisms. With the advent of genomics, people now realize that at a DNA level, there are sequence homologies that you see in organisms that are presumably related to each other. And these are shared sequences. So the argument is that these organisms had these shared sequences, that the ancestor of these organisms had this sequence that as the different organisms diverged from the ancestor, they too have shared sequences because they carried those sequences with them as they evolved, if you will, and that these shared sequences represent molecular fossils. And what makes the arguments on the surface even more compelling is that many of these shared sequences presumably don't have any function. So the question is, why on earth would a creator introduce these shared sequences that lack function? But yet it makes perfect sense if you think about an ancestral organism having these non-functional sequences that emerged through some evolutionary process. And then again, as that ancestor produced different diverging lineages, those shared sequences, again, would be carried along as molecular vestiges of the evolutionary process. And they're referred to by some people as molecular fossils that are found within the genome. And the argument is that this is even more compelling evidence for common ancestry than the homology that you see at an anatomical level. And so the idea is that the only way that you can explain this evidence is, again, from an evolutionary perspective. And one of the things that we're working on here at Reasons to Believe is what we'll call our genomics model, where we're saying that we believe that we can explain these features. And the way that we could explain them would be very similar to how Sir Richard Owen explained anatomical homology, that we would look at shared features as representing the work of the creator, a common design. But then we have the problem of what about the fact that some of these shared sequences lack function? They're sometimes referred to as junk DNA. And that indeed is a problem. However, there is a revolution happening in molecular biology these days where we now are recognizing that virtually every type of junk DNA sequence is turning out to have functional utility, or at least the different classes of junk DNA are turning out to have functional utility. And day after day after day, there are more and more examples in the scientific literature where this indeed is the case. And so the fact that these seemingly junk DNA sequences are turning out to have function allows us then to explain these shared features as, again, the work of a designer who uses a common blueprint and a common design. Now, we would also argue as part of our model that there are natural processes at work as well in nature, so that once the genome is designed, there are natural mechanisms at work that will alter the genome. And so some of the differences that we see between organisms could very well reflect the natural process at work, although some of the differences could actually be intentionally introduced by the hand of the creator. And actually, we know that some of these differences have functional importance and explain why human beings are not chimpanzees, for example. But again, some of the differences could be intentional. Some of them could be the work of natural processes. It turns out that some of the similarities that we see in the genomes as well could be the outworking of natural processes also. We are now discovering that there's a number of mechanisms that produce changes in the genetic material, but those mechanisms are non-random and they are highly reproducible, highly repetitive processes, meaning that just because organisms have common features doesn't mean that those common features arose only in the ancestor. If you think about this in evolutionary terms, they could have arisen independently in each different lineage as well. So the fact of the matter is what is oftentimes cited as the most compelling evidence for biological evolution and what's considered to be the evidence that we have to take as evidence for common ancestry doesn't have to be understood in those terms whatsoever. There are ways to explain these shared features and the differences from a creation model perspective. And, you know, I go back to Genesis 2, where it talks about Adam being created from the dust of the earth and the animals being created from the dust of the earth. They're made from the same material. The difference between Adam and the other animals is that Adam receives the divine breath. Human beings uniquely bear God's image. But yet, there's no reason for us to think that we're not going to be the same, or at least highly similar to other organisms, because, again, Scripture teaches us this idea that we're made out of the same material. The mistake is to assume that the fact that we are made out of the same material, the same designs, means that we must share common ancestry. It could also be that we are conceived from the same mind, where the same blueprint, the same archetype is used to create not only at an anatomical level, but at a fundamental level in terms of the genetics as well.
Fuzz, you describe this in the book, Who is Adam, right? What you just talked about right now.
Some aspects of what I'm presenting, some aspects of what I've talked about are being developed in recent weeks and months.
Talking about the genomics model?
Yes, in articles that are written as part of the Today's New Reasons to Believe feature. And in fact, I'm beginning to give conception to a book where the working title is Common Design or Common Descent, I'm going to look at these ideas that we talked about and explore them more fully in light of the recent advances that are happening in genomics. The recent advances that are happening in genomics.
Ken, how about the idea of common descent from a theological perspective as it relates to humanity's origin? Any thoughts on that? What do conservative theologians think about that?
I think a biblical element, Fuzz, that ties into that very well is obviously some of the differences between animals and humans is merely in degree, as you mentioned, maybe, you know, of a physical nature. But then there is that profound difference in kind, which would reflect what we say in Latin, the imago Dei, the image of God. And I think that has tremendous explanatory power. When you look to the Bible and you see the implications of the imago Dei or being created in the image of God, this puts human beings in a different category than the animals. Now, again, I like what Fuzz, though, is talking about because, you know, Genesis 2:7, man's created from the dust of the ground. Genesis 2:19, the animals are created from the dust of the ground. But the fundamental difference is the image of God. And, you know, again, I think that would explain a great deal. Human beings eat largely the same thing that animals eat. There is a connection that Fuzz has described in the form of their bodies and various things. But then animals don't seem aware of spiritual realities. They obviously don't have the cognitive abilities that humans have, the aesthetic abilities. They're profound creatures, the animals, but they don't seem to be able to ask philosophical questions. They don't seem to possess those qualities and characteristics that would make them godlike in one sense. And so in my book, A World of Difference, I have a chapter that is kind of a Christian anthropology that proposes what the imago Dei is, how humans are both like and unlike God, but also like and unlike the animal kingdom as well.
Fuzz, you've reported on a number of podcasts that humans seem to have interbred with Neanderthals and Denisovans. Some people might say eventually it's going to be proven that there's so much interbreeding going on in human history that the case is going to be pretty solid, that there's going to be some solid line there, that the case for human evolution might be proven, at least in the minds of some, that it's going to be hard for RTB to say that that there's been a distinct line, that there's been a creator at such a date that you guys have tens of thousands of years ago, as RTB articulates.
Yeah, you know, that for many people is troubling, the idea that there's interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals, as you mentioned, and then humans later with this newly discovered group of hominids called the Denisovans. And from an evolutionary perspective, the argument would be, while humans and may not have evolved from Neanderthals, we must share common ancestry and that we diverged at least recently enough that we still are able to interbreed with them. And so people look at this as evidence for shared ancestry between humans and Neanderthals, if not a direct evolutionary connection. But again, I think you could easily understand the capacity to interbreed as reflecting the fact that of being built around common design, a common design. We have common design elements in common with Neanderthals or with these other creatures. And that doesn't necessarily mean that just because we're interbreeding that we necessarily share common ancestry. So just from a biological standpoint, you know, one doesn't necessarily follow the other, or it doesn't mean that humans and Neanderthals must be the same species, or humans and Denisovans, because we can point to a number of examples where humans, not humans, but rather animals will interbreed with each other and produce hybrids. Animals that are of a different species will interbreed with each other and produce hybrids. And so what's being produced in the Neanderthal-human interbreeding and the interbreeding with humans and the Denisovans would be hybrids as opposed to, you know, the fact that the offspring that represent a members of the same species necessarily. Now, this raises a lot of tricky issues of a theological nature. I don't think that the interbreeding creates many problems in a physical / biological sense, but I think it does create some sticky issues in a theological sense. Because we claim that Neanderthals and the Denisovans would be animals that did not have the image of God. So how is it possible for a human being to interbreed with a creature that doesn't have the image of God and produce a hybrid that must have had the image of God in order for it to interbreed with other humans for those genes to spread within the human genetic makeup? And by the way, the number of instances of interbreeding in both cases is considered to be fairly limited, and it's because there were small population sizes of humans that the genes spread within the human population makeup. The view is that as humans began to migrate, they encountered a small number of humans encountered Neanderthals. Very limited number of interbreeding events happened. A few hybrids were produced. But because those hybrids were then interbreeding within the human population, those genes very quickly spread. Same thing with the Denisovans. As humans were migrating, they encountered Denisovans in Asia, and interbreeding happened. And again, some people of Melanesian descent would have Denisovan genes within them because of producing these hybrids. But it's possible, I think, if you think of the image of God in a sense as being a spiritual quality, it doesn't necessarily mean that because there was a biological union that the offspring would not necessarily have the imago Dei. Because if you could argue that if that offspring has human quality to it, human characteristics to it, it would bear the image of God. In other words, the image of God is not something that can be divided, that you have half the image of God or a quarter of the image of God, but rather you could think of the image of God as either you have it or you don't. And because there's a human parent there, you could argue that that offspring has the imago Dei. Or if you take a creationist view that God is intervening during the process of embryogenesis, when the embryo is forming, that God is intervening and not only controlling the process of embryonic development, like Psalm 139 could be taken to teach, or passage in Isaiah or Jeremiah, but that God is also creating a soul at that place in time as well, and that God is introducing the soul in that hybrid, irrespective of the fact that it is indeed a hybrid. So I think there are ways to address that issue, but I would point out that the interbreeding and what you do with that theologically is as problematic to our model as it is to someone who would hold to a theistic evolutionary position, who would argue that human beings evolved, and as they evolved, they somehow acquired both the physical nature of human beings as well as the spiritual nature of human beings. And that Neanderthals are not going to be humans, are not going to be spiritual beings, but again would be a side branch in that human evolutionary drama if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective. Well, as a theistic evolutionist, you still are having human beings that bear the imago Dei interbreeding with creatures that didn't have the imago Dei. Either that or you're saying Neanderthals, who are clearly a different species than humans, have the imago Dei as well. And if that's what you're saying, then you're saying something that's in direct contradiction to what Scripture is teaching. So this interbreeding is not unique in terms of the problems it creates, is not unique to the RTB model. It's I think, a problem for people who are theistic evolutionists as well.
And I wanted to point out that Fuzz is making reference to the theological question of how do people derive their soul. There have been two broad schools of thought. One, Traducianism, that human beings derive their soul from their parents, so it's passed on, as opposed to the creationist position that with every new human being, God would directly create a soul and kind of fasten it together with the body. So those issues have been developing over many centuries, and now these questions certainly highlight that distinction.
Well, I used to think that a creationist view allowed you to navigate this problem a little bit better, in that you would say, well, the hybrid, because it had a human nature, at least an aspect of a human nature, that God intervened and honored that and introduced a soul, and therefore you don't have this problem. But and that, you know, traducianism seems to have more problems because it's a melding of the souls, if you will, of the mother and the father.
Right.
But again, if you think of the Imago Dei as being all or nothing, then I don't know that traducianism necessarily suffers, because you could simply see it as the fact that at least one of the parents had the Imago Dei. Therefore, the hybrid has to have the Imago Dei.
Yeah. Yeah. And Joe, there are a couple straight thinking programs where we explored this very issue of how the soul is derived. Somebody could go on the website and pull those right up.
And there's a number of episodes of Science Newsflash where we address this issue of interbreeding with humans and Neanderthals.
Yes, people can access the archives. You recorded those in 2010. I think it was June of last year, Fuzz, you reported on that?
And I think we also did one when the Denisovans were discovered and shown to also interbreed with humans as well.
That might have been December of 2010 as well.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for your comments. Fascinating stuff, guys. Common descent, one of the common topics that appears in these kinds of discussions of theistic evolution. Thanks for joining us for this segment. Join us on the next one when we continue to discuss theistic evolution as it relates to Reasons to Believe's model.